Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present law professor Marjorie Cohn, who talks about the benefits of civilian trials for accused 9/11 terrorists, while criticizing the Obama Justice Department for prosecuting other detainees before military tribunals. Nihad Awad, executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, who explains why Washington's role in the stalemate in Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations reflects negatively on the U.S. around the world. And Jules Lobel, vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses why his group is challenging congressional action defunding the community organizing group ACORN. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The World Food Summit in Rome ended in disappointment with a weak commitment to reducing the billion hungry people in half by 2015 as called for in the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. An early setback in the three-day summit came when delegates refused to pledge $44 billion a year to promote agricultural projects in developing countries. The international aid agency Oxfam observed the near absence of wealthy country leaders at the food summit sent a troubling message. The group noted that the summit failed to identify ways for poor farmers to boost sustainable farming methods, while the agenda sought to increase biotech food production. The summit was called by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization to deal with the aftermath of the 2007-2008 food crisis when prices for basic food staples spiked in poor nations. Food riots broke out in over 30 countries. Famine is now stalking East Africa, where 23 million people do not have enough food to eat. At the close of the summit, Oxfam denounced the gathering as a lackluster effort, offering what it labeled as crumbs to the world's hungry, currently estimated at one of every six people on Earth. In the Ukraine, fear over the outbreak of H1N1 swine flu has created a near panic. With 24-hour news channels playing up the death count from the flu, Ukraine Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, in a tight election fight with President Viktor Yushchenko, rushed to the airport to greet a shipment of Tamiflu. According to the Washington Post, over 1.5 million people in the Ukraine have gotten the flu in recent months, and over 350 people have died. The World Health Organization suspects most of these cases are swine flu, making the country the hot spot in Eastern Europe for H1N1. Other nearby nations are resisting taking strong action against swine flu. Belarus has accused drug companies of fanning fears about H1N1, and Hungary has rejected calls to provide swine flu vaccine to an anxious public. Fear about H1N1 in the Ukraine spiked after Prime Minister Tymoshenko shut down the nation's schools and banned public gatherings to contain swine flu. In response, citizens overran hospitals and pharmacies demanding flu medicine. Former dissident Semyon Gluzman says the panic of H1N1 is a predictable response to the country's dysfunctional healthcare system and ineffective and corrupt government. Life expectancy in the Ukraine is 10 years shorter than the average for the European Union. In the early 1980s, a Pakistani cargo plane left an airport in western China with enough weapons-grade plutonium to build two nuclear bombs. The shipments finalized an agreement dating back to 1976 between Mao Zedong and Pakistan Prime Minister Ali Bhutto. According to the Washington Post, the Chinese-Pakistani exchange was detailed in an 11-page memo by A.Q. Khan, the father of Pakistan's nuclear program. Khan has been under house arrest since 2004. The shipment of nuclear material came with a blueprint for a simple nuclear device that China had already tested. U.S. anti-proliferation officials believe Khan gave the nuclear blueprint to Iran and Libya. U.S. officials have known about the China-Pakistan exchange for 20 years, but have been reluctant to confront the Chinese over the incident and never disclosed it publicly. According to Khan, the deal made by Mao and Bhutto came 2 years after India successfully tested its first nuclear weapon. China and Pakistan have enjoyed close political ties since 1950. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The decision by Obama administration Attorney General Eric Holder to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, accused mastermind of the September 11th attacks, and four other terrorism suspects in a New York City federal court has set off a heated national debate. Many Republicans have attacked the decision, declaring a civilian trial constitutes an unnecessary risk of new terrorist attacks targeting New York, gives Khalid Sheikh Mohammed an international platform to promote jihad and al-Qaeda, and will provide 9/11 defendants access to highly classified material. Although former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani has launched attacks on Holder's decision, the failed 2008 presidential candidate was himself a supporter of civilian trials in New York for those accused in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center and September 11th conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui, who was sentenced to life in prison by a Virginia federal court. But not all conservatives are criticizing Holder's decision. Former Libertarian Party presidential candidate and U.S. Representative Bob Barr, Republican of Georgia, American Conservative Union Chairman David Keene, and Americans for Tax Reform President Grover Norquist signed a letter agreeing that civilian courts were the proper forum for terrorism trials. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Marjorie Cohn, immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She talks about the benefits of a civilian trial for accused 9/11 terrorists while criticizing the Obama Justice Department for prosecuting other detainees before military tribunals.
The federal courts in the United States are perfectly well suited to protect high security detainees. We've had many, many terrorism trials and people serving time, including life sentences for acts of terrorism. And we have the Classified Information Procedures Act, which judges and prosecutors who have handled terrorism cases in U.S. courts say are perfectly effective in protecting classified information. So I think that this is really blowing a lot of hot air. I think it's political posturing on the part of some Republicans, not all, and I think that we should look at the facts, and that is that the federal courts have, since 2001, 289 individuals have been charged with terrorism-related offenses in federal courts. Some of them are still pending, but federal prosecutors convicted 195 out of 214 defendants. That's a success rate of 91%. And if we look at what's happened with the Guantanamo detainees, there have been no convictions by the so-called legal system at Guantanamo of any individuals associated with the 9/11 attacks. In fact, after 7 years that the Guantanamo prison has been open, the legal system there has led to the prosecution and conviction of only three detainees, and two of them had sentences of less than a year, and both detainees were subsequently released. So there's really no good reason to oppose trials in U.S. federal courts. I think more alarming is the fact that Eric Holder, the Attorney General, is picking and choosing different levels of due process depending upon how easy he thinks it would be to get a conviction. So some people get more due process than others. So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of 9/11, is going to get a federal trial with all the due process rights, and yet five other people, including Abdel Rahim al-Nashiri, who is accused of masterminding the 2000 attack on the USS Cole warship in Yemen, and the juvenile Canadian Omar Khadr, who's accused of killing a U.S. soldier in Afghanistan, are going to have to be tried in military commissions. An earlier iteration of these military commissions was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Now, they have been revised, but they're still fundamentally flawed in a number of ways. So I would like to see all of these detainees, for whom there is probable cause to believe they've committed a crime, tried in federal civilian U.S. courts with full due process rights.
President Obama's comments presupposing the guilt and execution of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as well as Eric Holder's contention that if for some astonishing reason he were to be acquitted, that he would not be released. And this really does appear to be a show trial. And for what purpose, do you think?
Well, I think that they want to show that they're tough on terror. They're confident, I think, that they can get a conviction. Even though, now remember, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded I can't remember how many times, numerous times, several times a day for a long period of time, ostensibly, according to the Senate Armed Services Committee report, to create a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, so to justify Bush's illegal war on Iraq, and that connection was never made. But he was tortured, and who knows what his mental state is now.
Critics of a civilian trial for these accused 9/11 terrorists say they don't deserve the rights of a civilian court. And after all, the 9/11 attack was an act of war, so this more properly belongs in a military commission. How do you respond to that issue of, you know, the venue based on the act of terrorism?
This was not an act of war. These were crimes against humanity. When 19 men, 15 of whom came from Saudi Arabia, they didn't come from Afghanistan or Iraq, got on planes and used them to kill 3,000 civilians, that's a crime against humanity. We were not attacked by another government. That was not an act of war. And I think the right has really used that to fan the flames of anti-immigrant and immigration reform. There's been, as I said, a lot of racism, and also to try to deny these people due process. The former Navy General Counsel, Alberto Mora, testified before Congress and said something very, very telling. And this is what Alberto Mora told Congress, quote, "There are serving U.S. flag rank officers who maintain that the first and second identifiable causes of U.S. combat deaths in Iraq, as judged by their effectiveness in recruiting insurgent fighters into combat, are respectively the symbols of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo," unquote. And then you look at the denial of due process to these people, and also the refusal to bring to justice the big-time war criminals, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and the rest, for their crimes.
That was Marjorie Cohn, immediate past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Contact the Guild by calling area code 212-679-5100 or visit their website at nlg.org. Despite reports of a possible prisoner swap between the Israeli government and Hamas, the Islamic party that controls Gaza, several recent events have decreased the likelihood of a just settlement to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. After months in which President Obama insisted that Israel must stop all settlement activity in the West Bank and East Jerusalem as a precondition of peace talks, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton praised Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for agreeing to slow down, but not stop, the building of new settler housing. Construction has actually sped up in Arab East Jerusalem, where Palestinian families are being evicted from their ancestral homes to make way for new apartments for Israeli Jews. In frustration with recent events, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas declared he would not run for re-election as head of the Palestinian Authority, citing the utter lack of progress toward negotiations and a resolution to the conflict. The Obama administration voted in the United Nations against accepting the Goldstone report that accused both Israel and Hamas of war crimes during the three-week Israeli assault on Gaza and recommended human rights investigations be conducted on both sides. The U.S. Congress voted to condemn the report as biased against Israel and concluded it should not be the basis for any further action. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nihad Awad, Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. The organization works primarily on civil and human rights issues on behalf of Muslims in the U.S., but Awad, an American citizen of Palestinian descent, explains why Washington's role in the stalemate in Middle East peace negotiations reflects negatively on America around the world.
President Barack Obama, when he went to Cairo, he declared before the whole world that the continuation of the building of settlements on illegal land in Palestine, whether in the West Bank or in Jerusalem, is going to make it very difficult to achieve peace. And the one who was talking was the President of the United States, who promised a change and new policy different from the past. He's not undermining Israel by saying so, and he was just trying to recommit America to the values of justice and peace. And by signaling to Israel that the illegal building of settlements should stop, should be frozen, was a welcome news by so many people, including Israelis and Jews who believe that what Israel is doing is illegal and unethical. So now, fast forward, when Hillary Clinton went to Israel and met with the Prime Minister and she praised him, she did not really push him to commit himself to the freezing of the settlements. That was seen as going back on the U.S. promise toward changing the policies, and it showed that we are still using the same old tools and we're going to get the same old results.
Nihad Awad, recently the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who is definitely considered a moderate, said he will not run for re-election as head of the Palestinian Authority in January, and even indicated he might step down before that because he feels no progress has been made in resolving the issues at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's not even clear there will be an election in January because the two parts of the occupied territories, the West Bank and Gaza, are split between the factions Hamas and Fatah. What do you think the Palestinians should do at this point?
Israel has most of the cards in her hands, and the United States has a huge leverage over Israel. So if we as Americans and our government wishes to exercise the leverage that we have on Israel to commit itself to peace and the peace process and to stop building the settlements, stop eating the Palestinian land upon which the future Palestinian state should be built, if we fail to do this, the Palestinians, they have little things to maneuver. And whether President Abbas will run for the election or not, it becomes like an internal Palestinian issue that came as a result of Israel's unwillingness to make the job of Abbas easier or just normal. They made it impossible for him to show to the Palestinian people that a leadership like him can work with Israel, and he is a partner. Well, we found out that Israel is not willing to be a partner, and that put the pressure on Abbas, and it really exposed his hands that he has nothing to offer his own people. And Israel has weakened Abbas to the point that Abbas has no face to face his people to continue to be a president and to run. And of course, the other scandal that Abbas found himself into is when he deferred and asked for the delaying of the Goldstone report, which holds Israel accountable on human rights violations. That weakened Abbas's position also before the Palestinian public.
And then Congress took a non-binding vote in which the vast majority of members, you know, excoriated the Goldstone report as biased against Israel, even though the report also criticized Hamas for human rights violations. What do you think about the role of Congress on this issue?
Many members of Congress, they take their constituents for granted. They think that if they support Israel unconditionally and blindly because of the pro-Israel group's pressure on them, that they will just go unchecked, unnoticed. If they realize the damage they cause, the image and reputation of the United States as a government and as a nation in the eyes of people around the world, I think many constituents will call their members of Congress to say, what are you doing? You are damaging our interests. The way you are voting in Congress, you are endangering the lives of American soldiers who are serving on America's behalf abroad because you are projecting America as being one-sided, that America doesn't care about the suffering of the Palestinian people, that America doesn't care about the international laws, and this all because of the blind support that members of Congress give Israel by supporting it without any account.
That was Nihad Awad, Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Contact the group by calling area code 202-488-8787 or visit their website at cair.com. Conservative activist James O'Keefe and his friend Hannah Giles traveled across the U.S. this past summer to offices of the group ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, where they posed as a pimp and prostitute. The couple, stereotypically dressed for their roles, asked Acorn employees in various offices for help in obtaining a housing loan to open a brothel for underage Salvadoran girls. Some workers attempted to assist the pair, while at least one office ejected them and filed a police report. These encounters were secretly videotaped by O'Keefe and later broadcast nationwide on the Internet and television, creating a firestorm among Republican legislators and conservative commentators. The videotapes were then employed by GOP lawmakers to launch a successful drive for a congressional vote to defund Acorn of all federal funding for the group's programs assisting low-income people on how to secure mortgages and fair housing education and outreach. The lopsided defunding vote attracted many Democrats, and victory was declared against Acorn, long a GOP target for the group's successful voter registration drives. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jules Lobel, professor of international and constitutional law at the University of Pittsburgh and vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He explains the center's decision to file a lawsuit challenging what they believe to be Congress's unconstitutional defunding of Acorn for declaring an organization guilty of a crime and punishing it and its members without benefit of a trial.
The suit we filed on behalf of Acorn and several other organizations alleges that the defunding of Acorn is unconstitutional, and let me explain why. The first and basic reason is that it's a bill of attainder. Now, most people don't know anything about a bill of attainder. In fact, I didn't know all that much about it before we started this suit. But a bill of attainder says that Congress cannot name somebody specifically and punish them. So they can't say, well, Mr. X, you've committed a crime. We're going to put you in jail for 20 years, or we're going to kick you out of government employment. I mean, probably the most famous bill of attainder case was in the 1940s, when Congressman Deves got up on in the floor of Congress and said, I have 87 names of government employees who are subversives, and we should get rid of all of them from government employment. And Congress passed a bill taking away all appropriations from those 87 named employees, and they fired them, and a number of them sued, and the Supreme Court held that was unconstitutional. What's unconstitutional about it is that the job of Congress is to pass laws which say certain such and such conduct is illegal or this conduct is inconsistent with being a government worker. And then it's the job of the courts or executive agencies to adjudicate who falls within that category. What Congress can't do is say you are guilty of a crime, because then Congress is acting as the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury all at once. And under our principles of democracy and separation of powers, Congress can't do that. Congress can only pass laws which then the executive and the judiciary have to enforce. If Congress gets into the job of naming names and deciding who it's going to penalize, then we're going down the road of McCarthyism in this country. Because then Congress can say not just Acorn, but then they can say to the next group, we don't like you, and we're going to punish you in some way, either by defunding you or by kicking you out of government employment or by putting you in jail. And that would really go against the core principles of our democracy.
Jules, does Congress have the right to cut off funds to an organization without hearings, without a judicial court case being heard and adjudicated?
Well, Congress has the right to cut off funds for particular activities. For example, Congress can say any organization that engages in fraud can be denied funding, or any organization that engages in tax violations can be denied funding. But in fact, of course, we know that there are dozens of corporations and defense contractors and other government contractors that have been convicted of fraud, convicted of very serious crimes, and still get government funding. In Congress, they've been protected. So even though Congress can pass general statutes, what they can't do is try a particular organization and decide that that organization is going to get no funding whatsoever.
So what's your goal here? Temporary restraining order, but in this hostile political environment towards Acorn, what really can be done to restore their funds? Or is that your ultimate goal here?
Well, our goal is twofold. One is to enjoin this statute, which we think we have a good chance of doing, because we think that, as I said, it's both unprecedented and unconstitutional. And it shows, by the way, that the very people who are out to get ACORN because they say ACORN has violated the law are themselves violating the Constitution. But second, we want to get a declaratory judgment and show more broadly that this kind of attack, this kind of legislative attack, without any hearing, without any due process on an organization, is not permitted under our Constitution, not only to protect ACORN, but in general to stop what we believe is a right-wing assault on the rule of law. And if we can beat back this attack on ACORN, hopefully then ACORN would be entitled to a fair hearing. And if ACORN is committed fraud or misconduct and they're adjudicated by a court or by hearing officers in an agency, then of course those agencies have the right to cut off funding to ACORN. But that would be only after some fair process.
Jules, how has Congress's vote to defund ACORN affected the organization's operations and programs in the offices unconnected with this pimp prostitute video news blast that really affected the image of the organization very negatively?
The effect that this has had has been dramatic on many ACORN organizations. For example, the New York ACORN Housing Corporation has had its mortgage counseling services totally threatened, so that poor people who are at risk of losing their house and need somebody to help them negotiate with the bank to reduce their mortgage rates now are totally at the mercy of predatory lenders. So that's one thing. The ACORN Institute, which is one of the plaintiffs here, which gets a lot of federal funds, has had to off about 80% of their staff. So it's had a dramatic effect, and I think we have to realize that the effect is not just on the organization, but the poor communities that are served by this organization.
That was Jules Lobel, professor of international and constitutional law at the University of Pittsburgh and vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at ccrjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.